It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there are at least 5 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus in the U.S. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the outbreak, who's at risk, and what's being done about it. First, in addition to our ongoing coverage of the impeachment trial this month, we're also zooming out to talk about the impact of the Trump presidency. It's been easy to get caught up in the daily twists and turns of politics in the Trump era, but our next guest says there's a deeper meaning beneath the turmoil, one that could fundamentally change the role of the presidency. In a new book, he says that President Trump is doing serious damage to the presidency and to American politics, in part by casting aside constitutional and political norms and by treating the executive branch as an expression of his own personality. Benjamin Wittes is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's co-author with Susan Hennessy of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we do see the daily headlines and get caught up in this story and that. But in the book, you say if we step back, we see something emerging, a trend emerging of how President Trump treats the presidency. Big picture, what are you looking at?
So our goal in this book was to take seriously the idea that Donald Trump is proposing an alternative vision of the presidency. Now, that may sound silly because a lot of people hear Trump speak and hear how scattered and all over the place his speech is and how chaotic his management style is. And they say he isn't really proposing anything. But our thesis is that if you look in a serious way at the range of norms that he has violated, if somebody violates this many of our expectations of the office in a fashion that is reasonably consistent over time, it's because whether they even know it or not, they are proposing an alternative. And so our goal in this book was to look at Donald Trump's vision of the presidency and to try to describe it as in as disciplined a fashion as we can and see how it compares and diverges from the traditional presidency. And then finally, to evaluate whether there are aspects of it that are likely to or should have staying power and to critique it and to sort of imagine whether there are parts of this thing that are salutary or whether it is quite as big a disaster as the president's critics certainly imagine it to be.
A lot of times we wonder if a president or any other public official is violating the law. Talk about why we should be focusing on these norms, the things that we're talking about may be legal, but you say we should still be worried about them.
Right. So, you know, normally when we think about the boundaries of presidential power, we think about things that are at the margins of what the president is allowed to do. So Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus on his own authority, right? And that triggered a question about how far the president can go in that regard. And of course, famously, Harry Truman seized the steel mills during the Korean War, triggering a major confrontation with the Supreme Court. These are actions that push the boundaries of presidential power. But what Donald Trump has done is largely stayed within. There are certain things that he's done that raise substantial legal questions, but most of what he does that people think of as abusive is solidly within not the margins of presidential power, but the core of it. So there is no doubt that the president is allowed to fire his FBI director. Even Jim Comey, in being fired, said the president can fire me for any reason or no reason at all. And yet the firing of Jim Comey taking place in the context of an investigation of the people around the president and their relationship to a foreign power raised very profound anxieties. Similarly, there's no doubt that the president can fire the Attorney General, and yet removing Jeff Sessions in retaliation for his having recused himself from the Russia investigation raises very deep questions. So if you look at the range of areas where Donald Trump has challenged our sort of sense of the presidency, they are mostly not at the edges of presidential power. They're mostly within the core of things that he's indisputably allowed to do.
Talking to Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You bring up the concept in the book, you and your co-author, of civic virtue as something that we assume our president will have. Not that all presidents will always be virtuous all the times, but that at least that's going to be part of their DNA. And you worry that it isn't for Donald Trump. Why is that?
So the concept of civic virtue, when we say it now, people kind of roll their eyes, you know, because it's one of those things that we're cynical people, and you know, we live in a culture that where we don't really believe in a lot of civic virtue anymore. But the founders believed in it very deeply, and they designed a constitution that really doesn't work without it. So if you think about what is the first thing that the president does as president, and the answer is swears an oath, right? And the oath of office, which the founders cared about enough that they actually wrote it into the Constitution, right? It is literally the only place in the Constitution where the document has quotation marks because they wrote a literal script for what the new president is going to say. Now, why did they attach importance to the oath of office? They attached importance to the oath of office because it was a way to require that somebody stand in front of people and promise to do something. You can't make the president force the president to be a good commander in chief, to be wise, to be to faithfully execute the law. But you can make him stand up in front of the population and take an oath to try to do those things. And that is harnessing a sense of honor and a sense of decency and a sense that when a man, and it was then imagined always to be a man and has always been, we should imagine a woman as well, stands up and promises to do something in a solemn occasion like that, he or she will endeavor to do that. Now, one of the things about having somebody like Trump who is sort of proudly unvirtuous, right? I mean, he doesn't just, as many presidents have done, engage in marital infidelities. He boasts of them, right? He doesn't avoid paying taxes. He announces that making sure he doesn't pay taxes makes him smart. And, you know, this is somebody who is proudly non-virtuous. And thus, when he stands up there and takes this oath of office, tens of millions of people around the country watch him do that and say, does he even know what those words mean? And I think this has a very deep effect on our ability to hear presidential speech, to respect the actions of the office of the president when the person occupying it is somebody who's not merely has human failings, but is somebody who's sort of actively rejoicing in his lack of civic virtue.
If I can paraphrase, I think, an argument from President Trump over time, it's that all politicians are corrupt and cynical, but they keep a veneer of this civic virtue out there. President Trump is the same as them, but he's honest about it. And I think that might be part of what his supporters might say is appealing about him. What would you say to that argument?
Well, I would say it's correct. So, you know, Donald Trump is a liar, but one thing he is not a he never lies about, and actually I think he's incapable of hiding, is his own emotional state. And, you know, that comes through to a lot of his supporters as authenticity. And the reason it does is because it is, you know, it is actually authentic. And there are all of these features of what Susan and I call the traditional presidency that Washington looks at with great reverence and sort of traditional politics looks at with great reverence. And one of the things that Donald Trump has revealed is that very large numbers of Americans look at it as hypocrisy and pomp and sort of theater, not as anything substantial or anything that actually reflects virtues of the system. And so I think he has pulled the, you know, the cloth away from our eyes on that, and probably in so doing, whatever damage he may have done, probably did a service.
We're talking to Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author with Susan Hennessy of the book Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been alarmed by the way President Trump has occupied the office, the White House? Do you see him as an outlier or someone who's really changing the presidency in the future? Do you worry about the precedent he may set for the next president? Or do you think it's a refreshing change of pace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about how the Trump presidency differs from those of the past? What worries you, concerns you about the character and tone and management style of President Trump? If you support the president, do any of his behaviors still worry you? Or are there certain norms you're glad to see him changing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hello. I agree with what this author is saying about our president. I think he's, you know, like appealing to the dark side. I don't think that's good. And what kind of example does he set for the youth of America? But what I called for was his statement about the Article 2 of the Constitution. I urge people to read it. It's not very long. Article 2, Section 2, Paragraph 2, says that the president can appoint ambassadors and all this sort of stuff with the consent and approval of the U.S. Senate. And what I wonder about is who in the U.S. Senate gave approval to for Rudy Giuliani and the Secretary of Energy and, you know, the EU ambassador? Who approved them? Who gave consent for them to carry out U.S. foreign policy?
Well, thanks for the call, Ben.
So the caller raises a profound question, which is, you know, so one of the issues we treat in the book, and the book was largely written before the Ukraine scandal broke. We wrote a little postscript at the end in response to it. But, you know, one of the issues that's embedded in that question is, you know, this question of how the executive branch is organized. And in a traditional executive branch, you know, the president sits atop a hierarchy that he directs by appointing people and by removing people, but that largely coordinate among themselves, and decisions rise up to the president only that can't be resolved at lower levels. And Trump has so this is what is traditionally called the unitary executive, right? There is only one president, and he appoints the lower officials. Now, one of the things that Trump has done that has been to dramatically disrupt the unitary executive. And part of that is that his management style is deeply chaotic, right? He kind of rules by impulse control issue. But the other factor is that in a way that is really unheard of in the history of the presidency, the lower levels of the federal government just ignore him a lot of the time. So you'll have situations like in the Ukraine scandal where the president directs lower officials not to testify, and a whole lot of them testify anyway, simply defying the president. And then after they do so, they go back to work and they don't get removed, right? There's a whole lot of – we cite a lot of examples of this, of people just contradicting the president on matters of policy. And so what the caller is referring to is one aspect of this fracturing of the unitary executive where – you bring in Rudy Giuliani to do the job of the State Department, or you sort of redirect an ambassador to run a policy area or the energy secretary to run a foreign policy area completely unrelated to what they're supposed to be doing. But another side of that same coin is that often when you tell people to do things, they don't happen, that we cite a number of instances in the book where the president wants to withdraw from trade agreements and people in the White House who don't want those things to happen steal documents off his desk, hoping that he'll forget about them. And so, the point works in both directions, right? The executive branch doesn't function in its normal hierarchical fashion, and that means sometimes you have policy chaos with non-executive branch officials like the president's personal lawyer running foreign policy. It also means the normal foreign policy process doesn't work very well.
Thanks, Willem, for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Benjamin Wittes, co-author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. What are your biggest worries about the potential outcome, even after Donald Trump isn't president anymore, of how this could all change the presidency?
Well, so there are a bunch. The first, and perhaps the most important, is that we are insufficiently committed to these norms to restore them. And I'll give you a very specific example of that. Donald Trump shattered the norm that the president doesn't get to treat the FBI director like any political position. You know, when the president comes in, a new president comes in, he or she replaces the whole cabinet. Traditionally, they do not replace the FBI director who serves a 10-year term. Trump fired the FBI director he inherited and replaced him. And so one possibility, imagine that the next president is Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, comes in and says, you know, Chris Wray is a nice guy and all, but I want my own FBI director. I would think it would be very hard for anybody to object to them firing Chris Wray and replacing them, say, with a, you know, partisan left-wing Democrat. Now, based on what Donald Trump has done, that would be a defensible thing to do. And yet if you say, do you want the coercive apparatus of the U.S. federal government to be swinging with party on a regular basis and go to party loyalists of the Democratic or Republican parties, that's a bad direction for that to go. And there are a lot of examples like that, things where he has just violated our expectations of the way presidents behave. And we have to ask the question, do we care enough about those to demand that they shift back? Or are we going to accept, for example, that the next president may have a four-year-long tweet storm that reflects, you know, every change in his or her mood along those 4 years?
And that brings me to another point that I wanted to get to before we run out of time. I guess the view of the executive branch as an expression of the president's personality, that's a theme you return to throughout the book. What do you see there?
Yeah, so I think the most profound level of Trump's vision of the presidency is the merging of the person with the office. And that, you know, we traditionally have this idea that there is the institutional presidency and then there is the person of the president and that those are distinct, right? And so, when Barack Obama plays basketball or George W. Bush goes running, both of which they did regularly, we didn't understand that as an act of the presidency. We understood that as what the guys who happened to be president were doing recreationally or for exercise. Donald Trump has blurred that line very dramatically. When his on his Twitter feed, most especially, you often can't tell whether it is the presidency talking or Donald Trump, the person, talking. Did the presidency just hurl insults at a random individual who upset him on television, or is that just a person? And there are in any number of areas, Trump has insisted on the more expressive dimensions of the presidency, sort of sublimating everything else, its traditional management functions, its expectations of public service and kind of good faith execution of the laws. And, you know, our basic argument is that this is a very dangerous direction for American politics to go. And the traditional presidency's insistence that these functions and roles are actually distinct and should be distinct is a crucial one to maintain.
Big picture on the violation of norms issue, have we as a political system put too much faith on norms to guide our president when we maybe should have doing more in terms of laws that would, concretely restrict the actions of a president?
So it's a very fair question. And the answer is there are certainly some things that we have relied on norms to regulate that we should probably at this point make policy decisions about and enshrine with law. I see no reason, for example, why it should be up to the president whether to disclose his tax returns. And you can kind of go through a number of areas like that. That said, the presidency is inherently an office of such vast discretion that at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to regulate every possible question in which a deviant personality like Donald Trump's will push lines. And we shouldn't fool ourselves that you can. At some level, you have to rely on things like civic virtue and basic decency to regulate the conduct of the office. And, you know, my basic view is that we should do what we can with the law, but you can't forget that at the end of the day, what holds that office together is an oath and not those laws that we put around it.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Benjamin Wittes, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's co-author with Susan Hennessy of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Last week, we talked to Victor Davis Hanson, author of the book, The Case for Trump. You can find that conversation at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll get the latest on the coronavirus outbreak in China and concerns here in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a bill introduced in the state legislature last week aims to protect children from being placed in the care of abusive relatives. We'll find out about that bill and the case that inspired it. First, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there are at least 5 confirmed cases of the new coronavirus here in the U.S. They're expecting that number to go up. The CDC says all 5 people recently returned from the Chinese city of Wuhan, the epicenter of that outbreak. So far, at least 2,800 people have come down with a respiratory illness in China. 82 have died. Wuhan's mayor says 5 million people have already left the city. None of the U.S. cases are here in Wisconsin. A dozen students and staff at UW-Platteville are being monitored for symptoms because they were recently in Wuhan. Kristen Bernard is professor of pathobiological sciences at UW-Madison. She's an expert in viruses that are transmitted between animals and people. She also worked on another coronavirus, SARS, after it showed up in 2003. Kristen, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me to be here.
Well, as I listen to the CDC and public health officials, I get the tone here as this is serious, but let's not panic. Is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair. I mean, the one good thing is we learned a lot from that SARS coronavirus outbreak in 2003, and we have really excellent public health infrastructure. So I think it's no reason to panic, but it is serious.
Let's talk about a coronavirus. What is that?
So virologists classify viruses into different families, and coronavirus is a single family within the whole group of viruses that we have worldwide. There are about 30 or at least 30 different species of coronaviruses, including, of course, the new one, SARS coronavirus, MERS coronavirus, and then a lot of other viruses that can infect humans and animals.
Are they all potentially lethal, or do they have a wide range of impact on humans?
Yeah, very wide range. So there are some other human coronaviruses that recently just cause like something like the common cold. Mm-hmm. So really very mild.
Are these viruses, or I guess let's focus on this current one now. Is this something that we think jumped from some animal, a non-human animal population to humans?
Yeah, non-human animal. Mm-hmm. Very good. I'm at the veterinary school, so I like that you did that. Yes, that is exactly what we think happened. The Chinese scientists have done a tremendous amount of research already. It's incredible. And they already know the whole sequence of this virus and know that it's most closely related to a virus that comes from bats. So we're almost certain that it's come from bats, but we think that most likely it went to another animal first, and that's due to its the relationship with the wild animal markets in Wuhan, and that's where it first started. And so now they're starting to look for that intermediate host, so a different animal that we think transmitted it to people.
And how does it spread among people?
It's now being spread human to human, so that's definitely now the case. It wasn't definite in the beginning. And most likely, it's only people that have severe disease, really severe respiratory illness, coughing, so then it's spread by aerosols.
Talking to Kristen Bernard from UW-Madison, professor of pathobiological sciences, about this coronavirus that is in China, some cases being spotted around the world as well. Kristen, as I understand, people try to measure diseases. They look at how fast it spreads from person to person, then how lethal it is. Like, let's take part one first. What do we know about how quickly this coronavirus spreads?
Yes. Fortunately, it doesn't look like it spreads super quick. There are some variation in different small outbreaks and between different people and different cases. But right now, it looks like about the same as influenza. And the way epidemiologists figure this out is they determine how many cases are infected from that single person. And it looks like about two people for every case. And that's not too bad, really, especially for a respiratory illness. About the same as influenza, about the same as was for SARS coronavirus in the 2000s. An example, measles is probably 5 to 10-fold more than that. So we do know viruses that can spread much more quickly.
Now let's talk about how likely this is to kill people. I did ballpark math just based on the numbers coming out. Here's how many people who had it. Mm-hmm. Here's how many people who died. I kept getting numbers just under 3%. I assume it's more complicated than that, but what do we know?
Yeah, it is more complicated, and that's kind of the back-of-the-napkin type calculations that we've all done, so good job on that. About 3%, but the problem is we don't know. If we look at the serious cases, just the hospitalized cases, maybe it's going to be a little higher than that. And we also don't know at this point who's going to survive or not. So we're still right in the middle of it. It's really difficult to make that accurate calculation.
There may be people who have a mild version of this coronavirus who never come to the attention of a public
exactly
health system.
Exactly right.
That will skew that percentage downward.
Absolutely.
More.
Absolutely.
What do we know about how to slow the spread of a virus like this?
Yeah, so if it's like the SARS coronavirus, it's really spread by close contacts with somebody who's quite ill. In that case, we want to quarantine anybody that's sick, that's been diagnosed with this virus. You know, prior to that, then we isolate them until we have the results, and then quarantine them. Then the very important that the healthcare workers are using very good precautions and safety to prevent being infected themselves.
It's flu season here. Yes. In the United States right now, and it sounds like a lot of the personal things we can do if we're worried about coronavirus are the same things we might do if we don't want to catch the flu.
Absolutely. Of course, with the flu, we can be vaccinated. We
right,
don't have
which we
vaccine
don't have
for this.
Coronavirus.
But absolutely. Washing your hands, you know, avoiding touching your face and your mouth after shaking hands with somebody or touching various surfaces in a public place. That's absolutely key for prevention.
Do we ignore something that's kind of like a household word like flu, but maybe, I don't want to say freak out, but get too worried about something because it's new and novel?
Yeah, I think that's human nature to get a little more worried than maybe we should. On the other hand, we don't have, if this were to become a pandemic, which I'm hopeful that it will not. And I think WHO and CDC also, of course, everybody's hopeful, but I think we have good reason to not think that will happen. We don't have any immunity in the population to this virus. So that would make it worse than influenza or something like that, where we do have people that have already been infected. They're immune. People that are vaccinated, they're immune. So there is reason to be more concerned, but not panicked.
Is this a disease where people with maybe some pre-existing conditions or younger people, older people, people with a history of respiratory illnesses, compromised immune systems, they might be more at risk for this and maybe should be a little faster to seek medical help?
Absolutely. In fact, it looks like mostly the deaths and severe cases are occurring in older people, not in young people. So that's good for the young. And the deaths appear to have mostly occurred with people who have preconditioned illnesses, such as other lung diseases, cardiac issues, diabetes, things like that.
I've heard with some high-profile outbreaks in the past that urgent cares and emergency rooms get clogged with people showing up worried that they have this disease before it's even necessarily here. On the other hand, we, you know, better safe than sorry might be in our heads. Are there messages out there from the healthcare system to people like when they should seek medical help?
Yeah. If you look at the CDC website, they have a very strict definition on who should be suspected to have this. One is having the difficulty breathing, fever, et cetera. So the clinical symptoms is like what we expect. But the other is having contact with someone who has been sick or having traveled to an area where there are the outbreak is occurring. So somebody in Wisconsin, in Madison, unless they've been in contact with someone who just came back from Wuhan, then we should think about influenza or even the common cold.
And let's talk about vaccines. You mentioned we do have vaccines for influenza. They do, not 100%, but they can make a big difference.
They do make a big difference.
What are the prospects for a vaccine for this particular coronavirus?
Yes, actually, I was listening to a report on NPR, I think, this morning, and that was by Tony Fauci. And he mentioned that the NIH has a vaccine under development right now and expects it to go into safety trials within 3 months. We wouldn't have a approved FDA-approved vaccine for at least a year. It takes some time to get through the whole process.
Now, what makes the difference between whether a coronavirus like this comes and goes and we don't talk about it anymore versus it becomes something like influenza, where we have this world path, this seasonality of a disease?
Yeah, so we were very fortunate that we were able to stop SARS coronavirus. I keep bringing that up because it is very closely related to that virus. And in that case, we did have human-to-human transmission, but it was about the same as we're seeing with this novel coronavirus. We were able to stop it after the with really good quarantine and public health interventions, and it never came back. We could find it related viruses in animals, but we never saw it in humans again after 17 years. So that one, because we were able to stop that transmission from human to human, we didn't have the good animal reservoir where we were being exposed. We were able to stop it in humans. Something like influenza has been adapted to humans for eons, centuries and centuries and centuries, and it's very difficult then to stop that. It's always going to be in some person, either without any symptoms and transmitted on to the next person.
Briefly, as we wrap up, a really big picture question. Is there something we can do to make it less likely that diseases will jump that barrier from our animal cousins to us?
Yeah, it's a really good question. In general, it's difficult in this situation because live animal markets are part of the Chinese culture. And, you know, if they had a little bit more barriers as far as gloves, et cetera, perhaps that we could have stopped it there. But that is part of their culture, and I wouldn't say that we need to stop all live animal markets. So that's a difficulty. There's also a related virus that came in from camels. It's called MERS coronavirus, and that spread from camels, and I don't think we're going to stop that transmission either. So I think just knowing where it comes from can help. We can avoid some people that are more at risk to handle those animals. And so I think it's something where we need good public health preparedness. That's more to be prepared rather than think that we're going to be able to stop it.
Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kristen Bernard is a professor of pathobiological sciences at UW-Madison. She's an expert in viruses that are transmitted between animals and people. We talked to her about the latest developments on the Wuhan coronavirus. The CDC says there are 5 confirmed cases in the U.S., none of them here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll find out about the case that inspired a new bill to make sure Wisconsin children who get removed from an abusive household don't end up in another one. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After a reportedly heated clash between Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and an NPR reporter, President Trump wondered on Twitter why NPR still exists. Coming up, we'll talk about the exchange in question and reactions from the administration, NPR, and others. First, a bipartisan group of state lawmakers is sponsoring a bill that aims to make sure that children removed from the care of abusive relatives don't find themselves in another abusive household. The bill is inspired by Ethan Hochschultz, a 7-year-old boy from Manitowoc who died in 2018 while in the care of his great-uncle who had a record of violence and abuse. Doug Schneider is a watchdog reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's been following this story. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ethan's story, painful to read, I'm sure, to report on. Can you talk about why Ethan was initially removed from his mother's care back in 2016?
There were multiple substantiated cases of neglect. There were 3 of those and 1 substantiated case of abuse. At that point, Manitowoc County Human Services decided that Ethan and 3 of his siblings would be safer in another home.
And that brought them to their great-uncle, Timothy Hochschultz. There were, it looks like, a lot of red flags. Can you talk about what was out there before Ethan was moved?
Sure. A check of court records will show that Timothy was in the legal system as early as 15 years old when he hit a guy with a tire iron in a bar fight. He was defending relatives or something at that point. And then he had multiple issues of violent reactions to things in the future, included a knife point robbery of a convenience store clerk, holding a steak knife to a man's throat in a Manitowoc restaurant. Child abuse incident in 2009.
And Ethan ends up dying ultimately under Timothy's care. I don't want to go into great deal, but can you give a sense of the kind of abuse that Ethan and other children in the home were subject to?
Basically, Ethan was worked to death. He was made to carry a 44.5-pound log around a course outside in the snow in April for 2 hours at a shot with limited rest. And basically it wore him down and eventually he died.
What do we know about the social service system what could they look at? What couldn't they look at to know what Timothy Hochschultz was like?
Well, the loophole that the proposed legislation is trying to address is that if someone has been convicted of child abuse, a child can't be placed with that person. But in Timothy's case, a child abuse conviction that had been issued by the court 2 years later was allowed to be pleaded down to disorderly conduct. In that case, Human Services is not allowed to look at the particulars of the case, even though the defendant did not challenge any of the particulars of it. Basically, he didn't contest that he had beaten a child with a board. And so basically the Human Services system has to be blind to that. It's akin to telling the jury to disregard a statement by a witness.
Talking to Doug Schneider, watchdog reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin, talking about a case in Manitowoc that's led lawmakers to tackle what he just described as this loophole in state law when it comes to placing kids with potentially abusive family members. Let's talk about Ethan's Law now, Doug, a group of northeastern Wisconsin lawmakers from both parties working on this. What are they saying about this law?
Well, the author is Andre Jacques, the Republican for from DePere, whose Senate district includes part of Manitowoc County. He's basically written something, and a number of people from both parties have signed on, that says basically if you've pleaded no contest to an abuse charge, if you're convicted of a lesser charge related to child abuse, or if your child abuse conviction is reduced after the fact, you may not serve as a guardian or foster parent to a child.
And the system, the child protection system, generally they want to put kids, when possible, with a family member. That's viewed as being best for the kids. This is clearly a case, right, where that was not the best for the kids.
Correct. The idea is you want to keep things as familiar as possible, so the system tends to favor relatives. It favors placing the child close to home. You know, ideally, you want them to be able to maintain friendships, perhaps remain in the same school. But in this case, I think if Human Services had been able to look at the potential guardian's record, they would have said, you know, hey, we just can't do this because of the criminal past.
Now, this story, Ethan's story, and his great uncle, Timothy Hochschultz, this was, he was placed, I think, in 2016. Ethan died in 2018. Here we are in 2020 with this law. Why has this taken so long to percolate through and have lawmakers try to change this?
Well, this is an educated guess, but until we dug into that, nobody had written in depth about it, and certainly hadn't made the connection that the guardian in this case had a previous incident of child abuse. So once the dots were connected, the senator was in touch fairly quickly. But it was a case, unfortunately, there are so many cases of abuse in Wisconsin and all over the place that eventually we become a little blind to it. And, you know, sometimes things fall through the cracks.
And what led you to connect these dots as a reporter?
I need to give my editors credit here. We recognized that there were a number of significant violent incidents against children in Manitowoc County in the past couple of years, including four homicides. And so we started digging in and looking at, you know, okay, are there, you know, systematic problems that exist here? Is it, you know, is there something that could be addressed? And once we started looking into Ethan's case, it became pretty clear that was just an egregious example of a case where, you know, child didn't have to die.
Are there other cases that you're working on, following and looking for other possible systematic problems as you pursue these horrible stories?
Absolutely. We're plowing through data on a state level. We're looking all over the place and trying to do some things that, you know, write some stories that can get some things fixed, that can get some loopholes addressed, can get more resources if that's an issue. But, yeah, we're not done reporting this story by a long shot.
And let's bring things around now to Ethan's case. What has been the punishment, the legal consequence for his great uncle, Timothy, and other members of the family?
There's been no formal punishment yet. The cases are all pending in Circuit Court of Manitowoc County. The guardian is charged with murder as party to a crime, three felony counts of child abuse, and four lesser charges. His adopted son, who's now 16, who basically carried out the punishment, is charged with first-degree reckless homicide, three felony counts of child abuse, and three felony counts of battery. Judge has ruled that he will be tried as an adult because of the severity of the crime. And then his mother, who's Timothy's second wife, is charged with failing to intervene, failing to prevent. They have, court appearances scheduled for late this month or early next month, but wouldn't have trial dates or indications that there might be pleas or anything like that yet.
And are they currently in custody of any other children?
No. I take that back. There are children in the family, but the adults in the family and the teenager are all in jail.
Doug, thanks for your reporting on this difficult story and for sharing the efforts in the legislature with us.
My pleasure. Appreciate your interest, Rob.
That's Doug Schneider, watchdog reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. He talked to us today about an effort aimed at closing a loophole. This would be in the state legislature, a loophole that could allow children and has allowed children to be placed in the care of abusive relatives, the law known as Ethan's Law. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll talk about the art and power of listening. Our guest has advice on how to become a better listener. We'll meet the author of the new book, You're Not Listening. We'll learn some skills on how to get along with people better, pay attention to what they say, and maybe grow as people along the way. The Art of Listening, that's coming up tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time. What do we like to do for fun around this here country when we get out of the house? A new poll out from Gallup asked Americans what cultural and entertainment venues they visited in the past year and how often they went. The number one winner, survey says, it's libraries. On average, Americans say they made 10.5 trips to a library in 2019. Well, that beats out a lot of competition, though, to be fair. Most of the competition charges money. Number two on the list was a visit to the movie theater. That's an average of 5 trips over the year. That's gone down from the last time Gallup asked those questions. And that just beat out live sporting events at number 3. Then you've got live music or theater events. I'm not sure how many of those were just, you know, people going to see Hamilton. Then National Historic Parks. Then a tie. This is kind of a weird tie between museums and casinos. The survey actually calls them gambling casinos. I'm not sure what other kind of casino there is. Down at the bottom of the list are amusement and theme parks, and then, this one's kind of a bummer, zoos. Zoos were in last place on this list at about 1 visit over the course of the year. I think our New Year's resolution late can be to get out to the zoos just a little bit more. Let's bring it up to 1.5 times per year. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.